Well, cool. Happy to have you here then. And today we have, and I mean, we already did a webinar together, but I guess you can introduce yourself. People know me regularly, so talk about yourself, what you do. Intro.
Sounds great. So, I'm Mark from Los Angeles, like I said. My company is Harbeck Marketing, and I help solopreneurs and micro business owners to improve their websites and put in place or improve their website conversion tracking to generate leads from virtual networking. I have a virtual networking tips video course. And I just launched a new service area last month on my website. So now I'm providing kind of a suite of if there's any really small businesses that ever turned to Fiverr or Upwork for digital content needs, or even things like a website user experience audit, I provide those kind of things at those prices for Fiverr and Upwork. But I work one-on-one with clients, and I give you a boutique experience and really understand your audience, your messaging, what you're trying to send out, who you're trying to reach. So now I provide a suite of those services. So website user experience audit, content for blog, email, and social media. I can help companies set up a Google business profile if you don't have it, or optimize it if it's not, if you're not getting the little green circle at the top of your profile that says it's all good. If you're in orange or yellow or some other color, then I can help you get it all to green to get the minimum amount of information that Google wants to see to see that your profile is all good. And I also provide under that Google review management.
Okay, cool. Thank you for that. And let's jump into topic number one here. That is the shift between the old analytics. I mean, it's been a while now. It's not like it's a brand new thing with the GA4, of course. It's been rolled out, what, last year in the summer, I think, was it? Well, what was the date for the rollout? Was it 24 July or something that they made the whole switch? Google ended the
Well,
GA3 pretty much for most people.
I think in around spring or summer of 23 is when GA4 was really released. And initially, they were going to give a year after that to, or actually, not that long. But yeah, they finally completed their cutoff this past July of last year, 2024. So that was the date
Yeah.
where you could no longer migrate your old GA property to GA4. But yeah.
Yeah, and so now switching, because of course anytime you make a hit to a website, it's always it's a surgical strike. And I know especially with WordPress, when you install a new plugin, what happens is many a times the site just goes down and doesn't like something else that's previously on that site. So what's the deal with GA4 when you switch to that and when you start installing those elements onto your site? What happens?
Yeah, so I wanted to talk about this because I was on a podcast recently where the host was like, reflecting. It's funny because I'm in GA4 and a lot of other Google products day to day, so I don't really think about this. But she had a good question that I think some people, especially if they don't, if what they're marketing on their website, if their business isn't really as technical as other businesses, like a digital agency, like I am. So one of her questions was, okay, if I go to install GA4, am I gonna, are my customers or clients, are they gonna notice anything? Are they going to notice anything differently on the website or have a different experience? So yeah, I just wanted to address this point and let everybody know that if you've never installed any version of GA before, any Google Analytics app, maybe you haven't installed any analytics app from anybody. So yeah, if you go to install GA4, that's not a concern. If somebody views your source code, they'll see some lines of code that are different. But for the public-facing website, for your customers and clients, they're not going to notice any difference. So don't let that fear keep you from installing it, especially because GA4 is free.
Yeah, and what's shocking, like when you said this, maybe you don't have any metrics. I mean, like, can't really imagine how somebody would operate a website without, tracking it. And I understand you don't need to; it's voluntary. But why would you even put up a website without knowing what's going on it? And of course, Google Statistics is not the only available one, metrics collecting. I mean, StatCounter is another one that, for example, comes to mind. I've been using for a long time. But now, of course, you know, the priority is that. But years ago, I started using StatCounter because I kind of liked the alternatives always. But yeah, I can't imagine why somebody would not. Did you run lately into somebody who has not had any metrics on their website?
It's rare, but yeah, I'd say in maybe a fifth to a fourth. So it's a pretty sizable percent. But yeah,
Wow.
it's not the majority, but yeah, still a decent share. Don't have anything on there right now, and they've never installed anything.
So you just put out a website and God will take care of me or something.
Yeah.
I
And some of that is, I mean, there's a real wariness even among marketers, but especially non-marketers. What was I going to say? Yeah, I guess for a lot of people, I find this within the marketing community, which is kind of surprising to me, but even outside of marketing and especially outside of it, yeah, when you even say the word analytics, people are like, that's math, that's technology, I hate it, I don't want to deal with it. Yeah.
Yeah, I guess we sort of live in a bubble where when we talk to tech guys with tech guys, we kind of automatically assume that analytics, like, how could I, like, I don't understand how, you know, for me, for my 20 years experience in websites and stuff, I'm like, I don't think I mean, I did put up websites and I did delay installation of the analytics because of the connection, but why would I want to have a website without knowing the statistics? Unless it's like a placeholder for future use, but if you have an operating business, and if you, even if you don't do much of like the e-commerce stuff, you still want to know if anybody's even seeing it. So to me, it's kind of like automatic, but it's kind of a shocking information to me to see that it's actually such a big chunk of people. So,
Yeah,
but.
and the other thing I was going to say, just to add another point on it, I have one longstanding client who doesn't, you know, I've actually offered, you know, I'll set up a GA4 property for you. They didn't want it. And there are some business owners out there. I mean, of course, money is what matters, sales coming in, and you know, it's pretty easy, of course, to track sales on your website. But yeah, there's a lot of, it's not the majority, but there's a lot of business owners, especially, you know, solo operations, micro businesses. Businesses that I guess in some cases you could say are less sophisticated, where yeah, they, you know, outside of like new email subscribers, new people on the email list, however they come in, sales, like I said, but there's a lot of business owners that are just like, once you get to certain, you know, metrics that are like the core metrics and that makes sense for your P&L, but there's a lot of businesses that just kind of want to shut off the conversation after that, and they don't really care about the additional metrics. So I think they should, like we're talking about, they should, you know, at least install it. It's free to install GA4, put the tracking in place, see that the data is coming in. Just give it a shot. Look at it for, you know, I would give it a lot longer than a month, but give it 3 months, give it 6 months, and see. And we're going to talk about it later in one of our discussion points, but just see what other information you can gather about what you're putting out there on your website, how it's resonating for SEO and other channels, and just beyond just sales and email list subscribers, open your mind to other metrics that can really, I'll talk about this later, but can really, besides just nice to look at metrics, some of them are vanity metrics. Pouring through the data in GA4 in the right way can actually help you uncover new market segments. And things like that that you might not have known about, and there's other things that you can really do to, you can really use GA4 in a substantial way to cut costs and grow your revenue.
Yeah, and I mean, I was just talking to my guys yesterday, and I was wondering about starting a PPC campaign on one of my products. And what basically he said is, well, what you got to do is first you got to prepare a budget, and then when you start a PPC campaign, the step one is you're not going to make any money on it. All you do is collect data. So you invest money into a PPC campaign to invest for, so for at least 1 month, you have to just collect the data, which then you come to these statistics and stuff. But yeah, and that just doesn't go for that. It's just, I'm just talking about the general principle. I'm not talking about specifically a PPC campaign, but this is how a PPC campaign runs, is you, for your first month of investment is data collection. And only then can you then focus the keywords and everything on, you know, so like people are like, oh, I'm going to spend a month, I'm going to get clients. No, you're not. First month, you're investing into collecting data. And so if you have a website that's running and the GA4 is free, why not periodically collect the data over a period of time and stuff? And then already you're starting from more than just point zero. I mean, if you're introducing a new product, you're always going to have to do new statistics on just that product specifically, because then later you sort of formulate your strategy plan around it. But yeah, this is just data collection. So, and that is always useful to me in anything I do. I mean, in personal life, you just want to have data. How many steps you walked every day? How many, you know, how many of this you do? How people count calories, sugars? I mean, you have data all over the place. So why not have your website collected? So anyway, let me go to the second point. Was that you have for us the seven reasons why we should give it a chance? I mean, maybe we already talked about some of it in the discussion, but you have something prepared for to show on the screen. So
yeah, great. I will share my screen.
What are the seven benefits of GA4?
I think it's pulling up now.
I have to approve you. As I hit my screen, I was like, oh shoot.
Oh, you can see it too, right?
Yep, it's on there now, and I'm going to hide us.
Awesome. Thanks. So yeah, I wrote a blog post last year, seven reasons to give GA4 a chance. So yeah, I just wanted to run through in my own thoughts and talking to, you know, potential clients. So here's my list. So compared to the previous version, which is known as Universal Analytics, or UA, it's basically GA3. So compared to that version, you are greeted with a more modern, inviting interface. It just looks better to look at. It looks closer to other Google products out there. And it actually has more date range options when you're looking at the data. And it's more intuitive when it comes to customizing and sharing reports. So that's one reason. They provide you with more data snippets in the report snapshot. The report snapshots, there's several, like on the left of when you're in GA4, there's several like main areas, and reports is one of them. So in the report snapshot, you get more data snippets at a glance views than you got in the previous version. There are more event types by default in the events report. And just a note, if anybody doesn't know what events are in the vernacular for GA4, so they're the actions, any actions that visitors take on your website, everything from page views and scrolls to clicks and file downloads. So in GA4, there are fewer instances where you actually need to use another Google product that's free, Tag Manager, to customize the events in order to show the common event types that a business leader or a marketing director or even a marketing agency is looking for. My next reason to give it a try is that you gain the ability to fully customize conversion events in the events report by using Tag Manager that I mentioned before in tandem with GA4. And you mentioned Google Ads before. There's in GA4, there's deeper integration and more granular reporting in conjunction with Google Ads. And I note here, this is especially important since GA or Google Ads is the biggest PPC platform in the world. Reason number six, like UA, GA4 includes the ability to exclude data from IP addresses. So this is your employees and or contractors, so that the data that you view is for your customers or clients only, or potentials. And this is actually a big advantage over the analytics dashboards built into some of the top website management platforms like Squarespace and Wix, et cetera, WordPress. And then my last reason to give it a try for GA4, so they added a whole new explore section, and it contains both many varied report templates, templates that you can just run with, and an interface that allows you to highly customize any report with dimensions and metrics that are most important to your business goals. I can help anybody one-on-one with this. The explore section is a little bit intimidating when you first look at it, but it is very flexible. I'll stop sharing, but that's what I wanted to mention for that.
Okay. Yeah. Those are logical points. And yeah, exactly. You explained the events and stuff. And the fact is that, like, for me, the Tag Manager and stuff, when I started looking into it, and I think I mentioned it last time when we were talking together, I'm like, no, thank you. It's just too complicated. I don't need that. Let somebody else take care of it. I just want the reports. I just want the processed stuff that I could get some data from and make assessments and evaluations. But the technical aspect of setting up the whole Tag Managers and stuff, there's different people doing that. Not me, thank you. it's very involved when you get into technically setting it up and putting it on different pages and tracking all the different stuff. I mean, it is beautiful because it is very detailed and you could do anything you want with it, but life's too short for me.
I get that, and that's where I come in, because I love making those updates using Tag Manager with GA4, setting in Tag Manager, setting up tags and triggers and variables. I love that granular work.
Yeah, well, again, like I said, that's why I'm like, no, I'll just do the design stuff. I'll be okay, and I'll write the text. But when you're installing it, you mentioned that you need to check out some. You need to include all the metrics, like, because at the installation process, there are certain ways you could do, like default. You could do certain features you can leave out and stuff. So you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, great. I'll share my screen again. I'm gonna actually show my own company GA4 property.
And you're on screen.
Great. So yeah. So and I had this come up with a question with a client. She wasn't understanding why in her client's GA4 property in the events report. And again, events in GA4 are all those actions like we talked about that users take on your website. But she wasn't understanding why the stock events report was showing a very low number of stock events in it. So if you see that, so if anybody's experiencing that, I'll show you. So here's how to make sure that you have all your stock events showing in the events report. So in your GA4 property, you'll go down to the bottom, and there's a gear tab. So you go to hit that to go to admin. I'm actually already in there, but I'll reload it. And then on the left, you'll see a submenu here. You go to data collection and then to data streams, and then click the arrow here on the right. And then you want to make sure that under, so it's got a whole event section here that you can see. You want to make sure that enhanced measurement is turned on. But even with that, even if it's on, you want to hit this gear here in the same section on the right. And this is where you'll go to, if there's anything here that's everything that I have here turned on, but if there's anything turned off, you want to turn all these on. So this is like I was mentioning before, this is where you'll actually be able to enable page views are enabled by default once you have this on. Scrolls, this will tell you if a visitor is scrolling 25% of the page, 50%, 75% or more. Make sure that measurement is turned on. Outbound clicks, tracking clicks that go off your website to another source. Site search, if anybody searches on your site, you can track that in events in GA4. All form interactions, even video engagements, video plays, and file downloads. So yeah, I'll stop sharing. But yeah, that's why I wanted to give that quick tip for anybody who is looking in GA4 at the events report specifically for the first time, and it's like, I'm not seeing many things here. That's where you would go in the admin area to fix that.
Okay, so and when you install this stuff and you track all these what you just showed to tie into that is and I touched up on that with the PPC campaigns, but when you start tracking on a website is when are you going to get some tangible results? How long you should, like, I mean, because you're going to start it and then the next day you're going to look and you're like, oh, look, I got four hits, I got this, that is working and this is not working. And so what is your timeline on working with GA4?
Well, it's like you said with Google Ads, where I mean, you'd want to have it running for at least a month, in my opinion, before you really look at anything and see what the trends are. It kind of depends on your strategy and goals, but there may be some things, like for example, I'm going to talk about an area a little bit later where you can see top cities. This is especially helpful for businesses with a physical location or maybe multiple locations to see, what cities are driving traffic. So with things like that, and cities combined with, you can also measure in GA4 top interests of your audience that's coming in. So with data like that, in my opinion, you'd want to let that run for maybe 3 months, maybe 6 months or longer to really give that time and see what's coming in, and give it time for more cities. If it's like a city resource that is linking to your website as a service. And or publications, things like that, that'll give it time for that kind of data to come in. So it kind of depends, but at a minimum, I would give it 1 to 3 months.
Yeah, I mean, this is all of digital marketing basically is people expect instant results, especially in today's impatient world. It's kind of like, well, I'm gonna take this, I'm going to start this, and then next week, and you see all these people going viral, and you see all these people having all these results and 1 million followers and all this. And I'm like, these people have been doing it for like 10 years though, right? You understand that. So when you're setting up the campaigns and people a lot of times they sort of understand it, like how would you say consciously, but subconsciously they're still desiring that that instant gratification that just never comes in the world of marketing. And that's why it's important when you're setting up anything. I mean, you got to, like you said, 3-6 months is like a minimum if you're expecting any major results. And then, and after the trial time of, let's say, a month or two, you may actually finally figure out that you're not, that it's not worth doing because the conversion is not there, because it may cost you more than what you could potentially make on it. So, but that still, you don't, nobody can tell you that ahead of time. And then you get into, a lot of people just want the money, so they'll tell clients all sorts of promises. You just got to wait, give it a year or two or three, and just give us, keep giving us money every month. And, you know, and then when I go in there sometimes and look at it, I'm like, but I don't see any way to profitability here. I mean, this is not the way to do it. If you want to do it, you either have to increase the price of the product, or you have to lower your investment into this venture, or because that product may not be, might be wrongly targeted for whatever reason, or bad positioning in the market, not even in the digital marketing. It'd be just something that can't be helped. And, you know, and then you get into the competition, and because we work in both countries, in two countries, so in Czech Republic, and then we work in the US. And again, my team over in Czech Republic said, you know, yeah, we can run a US campaign. However, the data is going to be vastly different for each country, because what's competitive over here and what you can make on the same product here, yeah, I can tell you how much you're going to put into it and how much you're going to get out of it roughly. But when you go into the US market, it's very much different competitive. So it's like, even in the same product, if you go country to country, it's just going to vary differently, the performance. And again, you need to collect the data. So it takes a while before you see any real results. And if, whether you're doing social media, whether you're paying for money for social media ads, or whether you're doing PPC campaigns, or whether you're just following and tracking your own performance of your store or whatever you're doing, is it's about collecting data, and it's hard to predict ahead of time, and it's important to stay realistic. But coming in and asking for anything in digital marketing realm, and subconsciously expecting instant gratification and results, and, oh yeah, I'm gonna put $1,000 here, I'm gonna make $3,000 back, because everybody makes that. Yeah, but your competition has been around for 10 years, so they sort of know what they're doing. And even if you hire the best, your idea may be unique, and unique enough, and may not have enough of data to really compare with your competition. And then in the end, you realize the competition is there and is doing it in a certain way. But if you do it the same way, you're not really going to succeed with that. So that's very complicated. I mean, it's just, you know, and then it's hard, and you got to talk to the people and explain to your clients that this is the way it works, and this is what it's going to cost you. And the first tangible results, because of course you don't want to be taking clients' money for a couple of, some companies do, but not me and not you, but they will gladly take the 2 years of money in campaigns, and at the end of the 2 years say, well, as we said, we didn't think so, and it didn't work out. Sorry, you know, you're out of money. So there are certain things you need to watch and track the metrics along the way. But again, you said the first time is, you know, 2 weeks would be bare minimum, but 1 month, 3 months. So yeah, it's kind of a long-term thing that we got to watch out for. So that's my monologue anyway.
Yeah, very true. I agree with that.
Yeah. So anyway, the next point was, and this was the thing, is this, the benefits of getting to your top pages and traffic sources and click form and conversion. Something you were showing, like with the settings, I guess now you can show us how it really works.
Well, I wanted to talk about, we talked about this briefly, but I wanted to dig further before talking about the benefits of GA4 beyond drilling down for your top pages and traffic sources. If it's okay with you, I wanted to talk about, if you're new to GA4, like we've been talking about, some of the first report sections that you should look at after you have the data coming in, like we were just talking about, a minimum of a couple of weeks, a month. So I don't have a screen to share, but I had some bullet points that I wanted to share. Give some ideas here for once you're in the report section in GA4, like what, because there's so many, which ones are important to look at. Okay, cool. Yeah. And this is for, you know, I tried to make this list, geographic and industry agnostic. So hopefully this applies to a lot of companies, large and small. So here's my recommendations, for some reports to look at. So the first one would be, you see this in several report views, so you really can't miss it, but there's several areas that point to a section called engagement. So go to engagement and then pages and screens. So this will allow you to see which pages are more popular than others. If you have high ticket offer pages that aren't ranking as well as other pages, you can set up and use a free, another free Google product, Google Search Console. So you can set up a Google Search Console property. It's also known as GSC, where you can see the actual keywords that people have searched for to find your site. And then you can incorporate more of those keywords that and phrases on your high ticket offer pages. And that's one change you can make to help them, those pages rank higher. But check that report. Again, that's engagement and then pages and screens to just get a basic sense. And you can adjust that report for whatever time frame you want. So if you've been running GA and collecting data for 6 months plus, then you can set it for the lifetime of that data and get a really relatively long picture of that. The second report area, you want to look at average engagement time per active user. And in GA4, they refer to unique visitors as active users. So that's just a general note. So again, the second one would be an average engagement time per active user. You can see this in the report snapshot tab, which is the first one in a vertical list when you go to the report section. So look for the one at the top that says report snapshot. For a client website that I looked at recently, this metric was only 59 seconds. Their average active user engagement was only 59 seconds. So that website had around 30 pages or has around 30 pages, but by far the homepage gets the most active users. So therefore, in reacting to this data point, I gave them tips to edit their homepage to increase this time, and that included things like adding a compelling video, a short compelling video, to the top of their homepage or as high up on the page as possible, and as well as adding an email list lead magnet overlay after the users are on a page for less than that average amount of time. So when they're on the page for between 30 seconds and a minute, to make sure that you capture those users during that current average engagement time of 59 seconds. The next one, check out, you can look up user age ranges on a chart. So you can see which generation or generations make up most of your active users. You can find this under user attributes overview in that report. If you find a disconnect between your target audience or your target lead age range and what's shown for the actual active users, then you probably have some copywriting work and possibly also some design or redesign work to do to get an alignment between who you want to target and who's actually coming to your site for age ranges. Another report that I think is pretty essential is at user attributes overview. You can look at gender breakdown for male versus female. And one client example, I was looking at a website where it was pretty well skewed. It was 60-40 females to males, but yet their website design skewed more male and older male. So I was recommending to them that for their future page edits and page additions, they consider using colors, design elements and language that appeal more to women than men. Another one is you want to look at marketing channels that are driving visits. And you can find this under traffic acquisition. And then and I can help anybody with this next step one-on-one if you want. But so you can, there's a report called traffic acquisition. But then once you get there, you want to add a data column for traffic source being session source slash medium. So I think we talked about this briefly earlier. If you have one or more physical locations, you might end up seeing city resource websites linking to your website that you didn't even know were doing that. That often happens. So here you can identify any medium to high traffic referral sites. And for those sites, a good next step is to reach out to them, thank them for linking to you. If you don't have a relationship with them, you know, reach out, thank them. That'll help set up a relationship. Talk to them and explore what they're willing to do to drive even more traffic to you. And this might involve a trial paid ad campaign. Next, and I've got three more. Next, you'd want to look at the user attributes report, and then go to demographic details. And this will allow you to see top countries by default. And from here, you can add a data column to this report to dig down and find the top cities by country. If you only market in the US, then you can just look at your top US cities for users. And you can also use this data in tandem with the user attributes overview report, and that shows active users by interests. So this allows you to match up top cities that are driving traffic to you with corresponding top interests, so that that'll allow you to research within those applicable cities the top businesses or resources or publications that align with the user interest that you found. And then you can reach out to those resources, businesses, publications to explore creating backlinks to you or possibly paying for ads back to your site. And another related note for that, I do work with some nonprofits. So if you're in a nonprofit, when you're doing that step, you could ask those entities if they can provide ads to you for free or at discounted rates. And then my last one was you'd want to go to the tech report and then overview to see the active users by device category. If you mainly market to desktop users, for example, and you're actually seeing a much greater percent of users by mobile, then you might have some redesign work to do on your site. And the same is true for the reverse. If you are mainly seeking mobile customers and most of your traffic is from desktop, then you need to explore if your site needs to be mobile optimized to begin with. Hopefully it already is. But if it is, then you might have to talk to your in-house team, talk to your agency, talk to your webmaster to improve it, to make it even better mobile optimized. That's my tips for that, for some key report areas to go if you're brand new to GA4. Report areas you can check to see how you're doing, what you can improve, and how you can use that data to improve your website and better serve your audience.
Okay, cool. A lot of information in there. It's going to sound good, but I don't know if anybody was able to keep up with all of it. But yeah, you can always watch it on rerun. And I'm sure you're going to make some edits out of that and post it someplace on LinkedIn and stuff, I guess, because you'll be able to use that. So yeah, but I mean, it's like I said, the whole tracking thing is a lot of info that you got to follow on that. I mean, it provides you lots of insights, helps you get across the platforms and get your message out, but you do have to know how to work with it. So, because sometimes there's also a thing called too much data. When you're overwhelmed with data and it's data that you don't need, it can either skew the report or it just gets confusing and you don't know what to pull out and may lead you the wrong way, or it can just be just hard to find the data, just pull it out. I mean, everybody can collect data, but just because you dump someplace the data, and that's why you were going through the reports, because you want to have different sections of the report and focusing on different aspects and elements. But yeah, just there is such a thing as too much data for me. I think there is we do this often with my son here with the YouTube analytics that they give you about the videos, and it sort of works in the same way. It's the same company, so you know, you get a lot of this demographical info and lots of detailed data. But then ultimately, when I watch the videos, my son goes into a little bit more depth of it, but I just look at just three or four different indicators or KPIs, and basically I get what I need from that, you know. So, but you got to know which ones. So it took us a couple of months just to figure out which ones make most sense. This is because then now when I look at a YouTube video, for example, that I make, and I look at the first hour of performance, I usually can tell how it's going to do for the rest of the time. But again, that was after a year of studying the algorithm and the analytics of that. So that's a little side story from GA4, but it basically works the same way. Once you collect data, you got to know how to work with it, and you got to know how to process it and how to come up with a meaningful report, which is, I think, the key here. Because, I opened up GA4, it's got overload.
Yeah. And those are great points. Another related tip that I would give is that, and this feature is greatly improved over the previous version of GA, is that any report that you're in, whether you like go to the explore section and just create a report from scratch, or you use an existing report and maybe you modify it a little bit, maybe you add, like if you're going to pages and screen report, maybe you add a data column for some other data point. Often my next step on that report is to add the traffic source for session source and medium, so I can see exactly all the sources that are delivering traffic for all my pages. But basically any report, whether it's a stock report as is, a stock report that you modified, or a report that you created from scratch in the explore section, any report that you know, to your point of like which KPIs, which reports really matter, any report you can save to your library section, which you can kind of find at the bottom of the GA4 menu. And it's really cool because, yeah, once you go to your library, then you only have your, you know, that's kind of your shortcut to like the reports that are most valuable for you and your business. So that's one tip, is to start building a library of reports. And then that way, when you run your analytics every couple of weeks, every month, I do mine monthly, then, you know, you already have a preset area and you don't have to remember the steps and recreate the report from scratch.
Yeah. And now pivoting from that, from a little bit from GA, let's get away from GA4, but stay with the analytics and stuff. And one of the things we said we could talk about also is your video social media posts. Then how you use that and how do you do that? I mean, because you do, for example, you do take parts of me from the last one we did. You took parts and you posted them and stuff. So how do you use that in and how do you get the analytics from it? I mean, what do you do with the analytics when you do it? And, you know, tell us about that, how to work with social media videos on LinkedIn, especially. I mean, YouTube is kind of, I understand that one, but LinkedIn, let's talk about that one.
Sure. I'll share my screen in a second to share a blog post that relates to this. But my model for doing this, one of my connections that I recommend if you need help with a custom CRM, and especially if you work with high level, there's this guy I know named Brandon Drake. So he has a really good video social media strategy that I kind of looked at and emulated. He probably has added more now, but at the time that I looked at what he was doing a couple months ago, he has, you know, a relatively limited number of, you know, like co-hosted events, like what we're doing now, you know, and podcast clips. And he's able to take those same clips and reuse them and sometimes change up the text that he's sharing in the post with those clips. So it's not the exact same thing a week later or a few days later. So I was kind of inspired by that. So I'm going to share my screen and share this post. Yep. I'll share my strategy that I do for this.
There we go.
Sweet. So yeah, this is another blog post on my website. I'm calling the low magic number of video interviews for a weekly content schedule. So, you know, a lot of social media or a lot of marketing strategy and digital marketing experts say that when it comes to LinkedIn, you want to be posting, you know, for the algorithm. We're always, you know, doing everything for the algorithm. You want to post for that a minimum of like 2 to 3 times a week. So if you can have one of those instances be a video clip that you reshare every so often, that'll really help you for your daily quota to serve the algorithm. So here's in this blog post, I kind of share what I do. So I had in my opinion, you could start with only 3 sources or three places where you get clips. This could be a podcast guest interview. It could be a hosted event or a co-hosted event, like what we're doing now. So things like that, anything that is a clip that shows off like what you do and your expertise. So that's the kind of content, that video content that would go into this strategy. So my first one was from Mods Rosso with the Business Library podcast. So that was my first podcast. So I had some clips from that one. Carell, we had our prior event where we talked about all things analytics and some other topics. So I had some clips from that. I partnered with Reggie Holmes last quarter to do a branding meets analytics webinar. So we had some clips from that. So in my opinion, if you get like a starting base of only like two or three clips, and that's why I titled this blog post The Low Magic Number, because I think this can be, I want this to be seen as not intimidating, especially for small business owners, for, you know, solopreneurs or anybody who's formed a new business, anybody who's a first-time business owner. This strategy does not have to be daunting. You can do it with a minimal number of clips. So once I had those 3 sources from those 3 people that I mentioned, so I probably had an average of three or four clips that were good social media friendly size videos, bite-sized videos that were 2 minutes or less. So once I had those, then I just put them into a rotation where I was doing the Mods clip number 1 in week 1, your show clip week 2, week 3, and then, you know, it just repeats clip number two from each source for weeks 4, 5, and 6. And then I have 9 weeks in total where I have clip number three for the last 3 weeks in the cycle. So that's the basis of it, just to show that this doesn't have to be daunting. If you want to set up a lesser week schedule, a fewer number of weeks because you have fewer clips, then great. And you can either share the clip plus the copy that goes with it verbatim and just share the same thing. And one thing I mentioned in this blog post in terms of resharing, especially if you reshare not only the same video clip, I'll stop sharing now, but okay.
We're back.
Thanks. There we go. My browser was behind for a second. The nice thing is that, like, if you get into like a 6 week schedule where you're repeating the same clip, like let's say clip number one, you're repeating it for the first time in week 7, like people are inundated with so much content. They obviously have busy lives. They're not going to remember or criticize you for, or you're not going to get in any kind of trouble or have any worry when it comes to resharing something that you shared, you know, quote unquote, recently. So I just wanted to write that blog post and share my strategy and schedule, clips rotation schedule for that, to help assuage any fears that, you can do it. And you don't have to, you know, bank, you know, let's say, you know, 10 podcast appearances in order to put the strategy into place.
Oh, no, definitely. I mean, podcasts are good, video is good, and just out of one podcast or one video stream like this one, it goes now, we're, 47 minutes into it, and I'm sure you could probably get 3 or 4, maybe 5 pieces of decent information out of it. So it's not that hard to get the content out. I mean, to extract it from something, because there's always something going on. And as long as I do regular stuff and I have, we have the RSS channel that we just dump everything on as it goes from here. That's only audio, but yeah, I mean, anything you do, you always repurpose and use it elsewhere. Because why make a specific another piece of work, you know, and time it takes, of course, of some preparation and just sitting there and doing it. If you can just reuse stuff that you already have, I mean, you have a library of stuff that you can just repost. And I sometimes have that with LinkedIn, where there have been times where I do save all of my former LinkedIn posts, even the carousels and everything. And I do sometimes go back and just pull out something from the past that I've done. Generally, it's not a whole lot, but hey, you know, if it's an interesting topic and we just recently talked about that and stuff, then, you know, hey, just reshare something from 6 months ago, because I guarantee you 6 months ago, only very few people saw that original post that you have that you're talking to right now, because everything changes and social media changes, the algorithm changes. And when it changes, it doesn't show everything to everybody all the time. And then if you think about it and people only see, like, there's only 5% of your audience, for example, that sees any one of your posts. So like, for example, I have the 3,000 followers. So, you know, and generally, unless it's something super that would go viral and stuff, I had that happen on a couple of posts. But generally, when I post something, maybe 100, 200 people in general on the average get that message, so which would work well with that, especially lately. I mean, there have been a couple of posts that the algorithm has boosted, like when I set up my service page. But then the other ones, yeah, generally I'm about the how good it is, how much engagement. The minimum would be like 100 impressions, and then the top ones would be a little bit over 300. So, you know, and that's the 3,000. And those are people that get it, the 5%, are the ones that are online at the time when I posted or that day. But people that come in 3 or 4 days, they will not get back to the stuff that you did. So if you do it 6 months later, a different set of 200 people will see it. The ones that will engage may be the same, but it's going to be different 200 impressions. So basically you just rotate a lot of the stuff out of history and you will always reach different 200 people. I mean, just that's the way social media game is played.
Yeah, totally. You explained it better than I did that. Yeah. Yeah. That's part of why you don't have to worry. Yeah. Even 2 or 3 months later that, yeah, you're right. That share, that 5% of your followers, 200 people, 300 people, whatever it is, you're right. It's swapping out. It's going to be a different set of people. So no worries.
Yeah. It's not the same pool of people that are online every day. You know, maybe 5 or 10 of them don't change, but the other 140, you know, They have other things to do. Not everybody's a maniac like me or you that will spend a couple of hours here daily. But, you know, other people have better things to do with their life.
Yep.
So that was just a thing. But, yeah, let's talk about a little bit. Let's get back into, we have a few minutes left. We said we could go to the top and maybe a few minutes over. And then I might have the point here because it's one of the topics that you suggested. And this is something that I've been really focusing on lately away from my website stuff. And it's the introductions via email and LinkedIn. How do you tackle that? Curious to see your thing. I can critique it. That's something that's very deep within me. So go.
Yeah. So yeah, I put on our list to talk about, I'm not going to share it, but I have a blog post about this too. But so yeah, I wanted to talk about introductions via, you know, either email or LinkedIn. So there's some people that I run into. This doesn't happen the majority of the time, but sometimes I will share, you know, I'll link somebody, I'll send a DM on LinkedIn, and I'll say, this person from my network who I've known for a long time, I want to introduce to this newer person in my network. You know, here's what both of you do. Here's why I think you should talk to each other. But some of those people, again, it's not the majority, but a decent chunk of them, I don't think it's good for, you know, that party, or in general, it's just not good etiquette to, I don't like when I see somebody from my network who I've known for a long time. And ironically, some of these people are kind of, for their LinkedIn posts, they preach that you want to be, you know, all the money is made in the DMs, all the action happens there. But there's people who I send introductions to where I don't get a reply from either party. And it really stings when I don't get one from somebody who I've known longer. So my advice is to, you know, whether you're like the newer person being introduced to somebody from somebody's network who's been there longer, or the other person, don't ever ignore, you know, if you're involved in an introduction, don't ever ignore the thread by just ghosting, by just not commenting, not replying. And so this is mostly so you don't send a signal to the person who's been in your network longer that you don't appreciate the time that they took to introduce you to a new connection. And related to this, around 65, this is industry-wide, but around 65% of new business opportunities originate from referrals and recommendations. And just a note, on coming up on March 13th, I'm gonna share a tip about this on my LinkedIn profile. So if you don't follow me so you see it then. But yeah, that was my tip, that I'm seeing enough people who, you know, both people on the thread who don't respond at all. And it's not only just like bad etiquette, bad form. If you value your longtime connection, you know, why would you do that? But not only that, not only is it bad etiquette, but you can miss out on business opportunities. And part of what I'm going to share in my tip coming up on March 13th is there's ways to like automate this so that you're not spending, you know, so much time. If you're getting a lot of introductions, you can set up template replies. You can have, that's what I'll talk about in my video tip on March 13th, but you can have, you know, at least two templates. You can have one for where you're proactively giving your Calendly link or whatever your, you know, calendar booking solution is, where you do want to have a call with this person that you were just introduced to because you can see at a glance that they're going to help you in some way. But you can also have another template where you can acknowledge the introduction made from your longtime contact and, you know, thank that person and also say it's nice to meet you, but you don't have to jump directly into, you know, providing your calendar link and moving towards, you know, setting up a one-on-one call. So there's ways to use templates for this to still be courteous and still acknowledge your long-term relationship of the person who you know, sent you the introduction. There's ways to balance this so that your time doesn't have to be taken up for this, and you don't have to worry about going down a rabbit hole of setting up a bunch of one-on-one calls with new contacts that you know aren't going to go anywhere.
Yeah, let me take over here now for this one. Let me comment on that. My perspective, my take here it is. I do have certain, like, sort of template scripts prepared, but I generally reply to majority of things unless it's a straight pitch slap. But if somebody introduces me and it's like a referral introduction, then of course that's definitely given that you should talk
to the people, and you should communicate. And that was actually one of the no-shows yesterday, was somebody who introduced us, and that's why I was like, you know, I said, all right, no problem, I'll do that for free. So and that person didn't show up, and I was like, okay, well, so from now on, even referrals get the paid link for setting the schedule with me. But yeah, you have to kind of again feel your way and stuff around this. But what I do is I definitely reply to everything. And yeah, then I have, because I use HubSpot, so I have a link, schedule link, not Calendly. I have a thing with Calendly, and I just let people openly know it. I think Calendly is just a complication in life to me, because it does not integrate into anything else. Any kind of scheduling you do with Calendly, you have to then manually put it into some other place and stuff, because it's not, so where I use HubSpot, it just goes automatically into my CRM, and then I could just click twice and send a template for whatever I have there, because HubSpot allows you to have like 1,000 different templates and for emails and communication, whatever else. But yeah, I have, I send the Calendly, the HubSpot link that I have prepared just in the app, and sort of just write 2 or 3 things. I mean, the templates, I'm like, for the communication, I have them. But I'm like, I'm not really using them, because I just type it out. And usually you're not going to get hundreds of referrals from people and stuff. Half of those are going to be just pitch slaps. And so when somebody asks me like, oh, I'll be interested in, this happened a couple of weeks ago. Somebody said, oh, yeah, we'd like to have you on a podcast. And it was funny, because I was like, I sent them a reply. I said, yeah, sure, no problem. Here is my schedule and link to talk about that. And they never replied. I'm like, okay. And the same thing was another guy that said, oh yeah, we're doing this data collection stuff, and we'd like you to participate in this to help us out. And I'm like, okay, no problem, here's the scheduling link, you know, I'll be glad to do it. We even connected with like 3 other people and stuff and to talk about it. They never replied. So I studied this for a while, and I thought about it, and I'm like, why are these people not, and this is just 2 days ago, why are these people not replying to me? And I'm like, because what happens is on LinkedIn there is a little feature called the InMail. And the platform treats DMs different than emails. They go into the same inbox. I could show this, because I'm going to share my screen here, and I'm going to go to messaging, and I will show you. This is what I got yesterday. Let me share this. This is on my head. Share the screen and share the tab. Messaging LinkedIn, share. There we go. So this guy sends me, and it's here, it's InMail. It says InMail. And this guy said, I don't even know what he wanted. This is a medical company that is planning to set up. Your expertise and experience will be valuable and helpful for a new project if you're interested, blah, blah, blah. That's an InMail. I didn't even reply to that because I couldn't care less. And then there's another InMail that says, does your business need funding? And this guy's offering me like business loans. Again, I don't reply to that. Like, you know, that's not a referral that somebody would send to me, and that's not a guy I'm interested in. So, but there's one here, and it shows up dark here. But if I click on it, I believe this was the one, or maybe it was the one. Well, one of these, and these black ones. That's why I noticed just now. Yeah, I mean, not just now, but like 2 days ago. These dark ones, those are InMails as well. And I'm like, because when I click on InMails, I think they line up. See. And so it's weird how it disappears, but then when you go into the regular messaging app over here, they sort of do appear in here, just you now. So I guess they left, or the email was deleted, InMail was deleted or something. It's really weird how it works, how this is AJ Riedel. So yeah, she's the one that sent the email over here. It was the guy. So, you know, that's why people say, oh, and this is touching upon the, your comment about you said about DMs and stuff that people use, and you see a lot of the posts say, oh, DMs is where the magic happens. I see just blank spots and empty stuff. Like, I don't believe that anything happens in the DMs on LinkedIn, especially in this mess. So I'm like, no, that's my take on it. I'm like, yeah, the hell with DMs. Somebody sends me a DM like here, you know, it was like, oh yeah, would you like to do this, you know, blah, blah. I'm like, yeah, sure, no problem, you know, and I send the link and never got a reply. Then I realized it was an InMail, but you know, but I send the regular mail because I don't have the InMail feature. So when you reply to an InMail, you're actually just replying regular message. But you know, but LinkedIn is really strange in working with the inbox. I think it's the worst inbox ever. The that I've seen, and I'm gonna stop sharing this and get back to us. But yeah, so that's my take on this, and yeah, definitely take the communication to off the platform as soon as possible. I mean, if you're interested in whatever that person does, take it off the platform. Go to that Zoom, follow up in HubSpot or whatever other CRM you're using, you know. And I believe that's where you're gonna get the better value, because I just showed you the example of how poorly that's performing. And InMail is supposed to be like where you talk to people and you get, you know, oh, you could, I guess in combination with Sales Navigator, it may be a little bit more better, but it's, to me, that still feels like having, like sending out cold emails, you know. And we know the percentage on that is like 1%. This is like, why am I going to spend all day? And LinkedIn does not allow any automation, so, which in this case is a very good thing, because, you know, so you send out 1,000 invites to people to, you know, so you're basically just spamming, nothing else. And if you're selling something for more than like $5 or $50, you're not going to have any success anyway, because you're just, to me, it feels like you're devaluing your own product. Is like, you know, like by sending out cold emails and cold DMs and just sort of like automatically kind of like, it's, you know, if you're selling value, you should stand behind your brand and you sell yourself and be proud of what you're doing, and not resort to these scammy, fishy smelling sort of strategies of InMail and dark boxes and deleted and pitch, slab, leave, run, hit, run. No, I don't know. To me, it's just, I like personal contact. I'm old school in that.
Yeah, me too. When I first started my business in mid 2023, I experimented with some, I paid for, you know, access to Gmail so I could do, you know, bulk emailing, and luckily didn't have my Gmail account, you know, permanently deactivated, but I had a day or two where I had, and I wasn't even sending out that many. I was maybe sending out 50 a day, you know, not, you know, hundreds and hundreds like some people do. And I still got, you know, flagged for, you know, possible.
That's about the limit, is about 50 a day is in an hour, I think it was. But if you do it regularly, they'll follow it and they'll give you a restriction.
Yeah. So very quickly after the first couple of months, I moved to, now I don't, I mean, I technically do send cold emails, but it's always, there's always context behind it. Almost always when I'm sending a cold email now, it has the context of, I've at least met somebody. It's based on us, me and the other person both being in a virtual event, networking event. And either I just learned about them in the main room or I actually connected with them more in the breakout room. So that's the only way that I send that out. And then I can highlight that mutual event that we both know that we attended in the subject line. So it's more relevant and, you know, doesn't have any spam keywords in the subject line that could get it to not even reach their inbox. So that's the way that I do it.
Yeah, and it's especially with attachments that you get into a lot of trouble if you send attachments, because I just connected with somebody, we had a Zoom, I sent him an email, he saw it, then I sent him a follow-up email with some files because he wanted some explanation of some of the brochures that I was doing, and I don't think that email ever got to him. So I resent the same email with just the text body without the files, and he did open that one. So I think even attachments and stuff can limit that, because especially when you're making a new connection with somebody, their email is not trained to receive anything from you, no matter what email you're using. And it's just server, and even through the HubSpot and stuff, is if I use their their email, they're sort of, what's the mass spam? I just don't use it, but what's the name of the bulk email sending, the most popular one?
I mean, I use Gmail. I think that's one of them.
Yeah. So yeah, you use that, but there was one that's the biggest one. I forget. I did a bunch of stuff on it, but the name escapes me, because I started using Echo Mail, which is a watered down version of that, and that's a pretty good one too. But HubSpot has the same thing. It's kind of like a bulk email server stuff. But still, even if it comes from this specially designated commercial email server, because it had like 5 megabytes of attachments, it just didn't go through. So I'm like, yeah. So then I resend it without it, and it went. And then it's sort of like especially when you're doing the emails, you sort of have to warm it up. It's not like it was 10 years ago where you got 100 spams into your mailbox. I don't know if you remember those times, of course. So
yeah,
that was some wild times.
It sure was.
But today is a little bit different. And so, yeah, you definitely want to make it personal. And I think it is important to make the first contact, whether it's on LinkedIn. And you guys, the best way on LinkedIn, of course, is through engagement. LinkedIn likes it. And, you know, you kind of just get through engagement. And then you either move it to a networking event or in the DMs, of course. But when I send it to people I have not met with and we just connected, and I do see some potential value that I can bring to them, they could bring to me, then I will send the thing, the link. And that's what my son has had a lot of success with it. Send the link to Get to Know Link, which is a free meeting with me because I'm interested in making a connection as well. Whereas if somebody says, you know, can I consult you on services? Yeah, sure. Here's a link for $250 and you can consult me, you know. So, but if it's kind of like this networking stuff, I have two different links for that. But yeah, it's just, I send out the link. Listen, let's get to know each other. Let's see if there is something in there. Let's see what your business is. Let me see what my business is. And then you take it off the platform. Then you can invite them to like the Good Business Karma. We both attend. And then you start sort of forming that relationship on LinkedIn and off of LinkedIn. And I always do encourage people to try to get as much engagement on LinkedIn as possible and reciprocate, not for the sake of just reciprocating, but do that and to endorse other profiles and stuff like that, because that's the contact points. I mean, you want to make a sale and you don't need to sell to everybody you meet, but you still need the 6 contact points, even for the referral and stuff. You still need at least 6 contact points. So engaging regularly, you know, increases A, your performance in the algorithm, and B, it, you're in the eyes of that other person, and it's kind of like polite communication, and it's public where both of you win, because you're helping to boost his posts and he helps you, and then you also communicate off the platform. So it's kind of, you know, but it's wonderful today because your playing field is unlimited, where 20 years ago you had to go to an in-person event, you have to call him up on the phone, and the best way to stay in touch was to send postcards by mail, not email, but mail. I don't know if you remember those days, we used to get like postcards from companies and say, oh, thank you and for your business and stuff. So that was the only way you actually reach out to people. This is not 20, this is more like 30 years ago, but still, that's how you did business. And today it's just like you click and you do a webinar for somebody you've never met in person, but you see each other all the time. So you kind of gain each other's trust, and you could work together on things. And so some relationships take a month, 3 months, and it goes back to the analytics. I mean, you have to do the work. You have to collect the data about the person, sort of, because how would you know otherwise if you can work together?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that about wraps it up for today's session about GA4. We ended up on LinkedIn anyway.
That's right. We covered a lot of ground.
Yeah. So, but yeah, anything else you want to add today in closing? Notifications, information. You said you have something on, you're going to be live, or you're going to be doing something on the 13th, which is in 2 weeks.
Yeah. I'll be sending a video tip. I do some direct to camera marketing and networking related video tips. So yeah, I'll share. I think my next one coming up is on March 13th. Yeah. My website is harbeckmarketing.com. People can reach me there.
Okay, great. And I'm going to have another webinar next week, and I'm just going to post it today in a little while. As soon as we get off, I'm going to start posting the other event. And I thank you for your insights. And like I said, to me, it's sort of a mysterious village that I enter very rarely. I'll do the website, I'll do the design, I'll do all sorts of stuff on social media, but I will not visit the ancient village of GA4 or the most modern village. To me, it's like fantasy land. So I'm like, yeah, I like the data from it. I don't want to dabble in it. So, but yeah, thank you for that. And I hope you have a great rest of the day. Thanks for everybody attending live or post live. And yeah, reach out to us if you need anything. We're here. Ask questions. We'll answer them in the comments, even tonight. So have a great day. Bye-bye.
Thank you.